Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke. I think that Bobby Heenan should have been the King of England. I think the charges against Pat Passon were more below the belt than an Eric Watts dropkick, and I would allow jokes about Mel Phillips in this intro, but I don't want to get off on the wrong foot.
I'm G. John Chase, and I have a great singing voice just like Sensational Sherry. I'm as hard as nails, and all my jokes are about as pre-planned and creative as a coal miner's glove match.
I'm Carl Jones, and I'm about as quick on my feet as Papa Shango during a main event running. Unlike the Ultimate Warrior, the massive loss of my body mass didn't lead to people questioning whether or not I'd died and been replaced, and for reasons that have never been properly explained to me, I was once declined a job from the World Wrestling Federation because it was decided my feet wouldn't look good in open-toe sandals.
And I'm Kieran O'Rourke. In 1992, I was about 10 years old and about 6 months away from the start of a six-year battle with acne. Luckily, by that point, I'd already lost my virginity.
This is the panel for the 15th Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear us talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly of 1992. Next. Hello everyone and welcome to the 15th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke alongside G. John Chase.
I'm looking forward to this one.
Carl Jones.
Hipsters in the house.
And Kieran O'Rourke.
Evening.
And on this evening, we have a fantastic topic at hand. The good, the bad, and the ugly of the year 1992. We've done this format before, a very fun, unique way to do a year in review. Taking certain different elements of the year and kind of breaking them down, discussing them. And we've done 2 years before this. We did 1994 and 2000, which you can find in the archives if you subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Squared Circle Gazette Radio. And there's a lot of things that immediately jump to mind when we talk about 1992. There's just so many different topics in and out of the ring. For previous Good, Bad and Ugly podcasts, we've kind of had an individual topic in our usual roundtable format. We're going to do this a little bit differently because the volume of the feedback is pretty immense. It seems to be growing by the week. So we're going to use you guys as a crutch, if you will. And we're going to use you guys to anchor the direction of the show.
That's it. You did the hard work and we're reaping the rewards.
That's right, folks. So we're going to start with Steve Bochenek, who talks about The Great. Obviously, we asked you guys what The Good, Bad and Ugly was. Steve Bochenek said The Great was the 1992 Royal Rumble. As a fan who grew up in the Jim Crockett territory in Baltimore, Flair was king. Seeing him go up north and put on that legendary performance validated our fandom. The Brain's performance on commentary was almost as legendary. And this is something that we talked about last week on the best non-WrestleMania pay-per-views of all time. It's actually quite interesting because I believe Steve's point is exactly what you mentioned, Kieran, in terms of the NWA crowd, the Ric Flair fans, seeing their fandom validated, as Steve says. In terms of,
did I say that?
Yeah, you did.
It's a good point, that.
Yeah, it's a great point. and obviously the merit that puts on this pay-per-view, but the Royal Rumble 1992 does come up a lot in terms of being a massive positive for the year.
Yeah, it was obviously one of the standout shows of that year. And as kind of stated in the last podcast, it was just it was quite a major moment for Ric Flair. Flair didn't really get many of those moments during the year, but Royal Rumble's definitely a highlight. And I actually think that Heenan's commentary is probably even more legendary than the Ric Flair actually winning the Rumble.
Well, that's something interesting about Heenan's commentary. And Gorilla Monsoon is someone who gets mixed reviews, let's say, for his commentary. I personally always loved it, but maybe that was sort of having the rose-tinted specs on being a kid and all that sort of thing.
But yeah, Meltzer always buried him, and that affects a lot of people's opinions.
But you watch it back, and Heenan is fantastic, but Monsoon is a great four from the way they're going back and forth, and the fair to Flair, and you're going to lose your meal ticket, and all that sort of thing. They play off each other so well. Yeah. But to get back to the point of the event itself, I've always thought it was probably top two in terms of Rumble events.
Yeah.
For me personally, I think it's the best Rumble they've ever done.
Match.
Best Rumble match, yeah. 2001 is probably a stronger show overall, but as a standalone Rumble, I think even to this day, I'd still go in 92.
Yeah. Oh, 2000's got to be in there, Carl. Come on.
I know. Yeah,
2000 was a great show. But I was never the biggest fan of the Rumble itself.
Yeah, that's true. And I will say, in terms of, like, and you mentioned last week, Chase, in terms of percentage of the Rumble pay-per-view that was good, obviously between the Flair, you know, mega performance, also the Piper title win that we can't overlook, a good opener. Yeah. There's a lot of this show that was very good. Tiger Rick from the UK Fan Forum also says the good, the Royal Rumble, specifically Ric Flair's performance. One of wrestling's greatest ever individual performances, in my opinion. Absolutely perfect for Flair's various flips, flops, and facials. Bobby Heenan brilliantly enhances it, but Flair is marvellous. And then he cuts one of the most brilliant and iconic promos in company history.
Can I just say, I think Chase is going to go gloss over it in Wax Lyrical in a second. I just want to, because it kind of ties into the point I was about to make. It was as fun as it was, as good a performance it was, is it overrated? Particularly the Flair performance and in terms of being the best put together Rumble, because it meant so much, and it had a match long storyline that actually made sense and was important. But in terms of the Flair performance, like a truly great performance, was it a performance that showed some of his past glories, and is it really up there with his truly like his great performances in the NWA?
I think when it comes to Ric Flair's performance, I think it's like the kind of same retrospective as you'd have with, say, like the first ever ladder match and so on, where, like, you know, some people today might not think that ladder match holds up any longer, but you have to be, like, at that time, understand how good that match was. I think it's the same goes for Flair's performance in the Rumble, because at that time, you hadn't had someone go in so early in the Rumble and last to the end. That was, like, the first time, you know. But I think it was just that great thing of, like, Ric Flair was coming out, claiming that he was the real world champion for ages, and he was, like, being the braggish kind of asshole, and he's so positive he's going to win the title, and then he comes out at number three, and the crowd are just laughing at him as he's walking out, because they're thinking, like,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, you can kiss her goodbye!
Yeah. It's like, yeah, you're not going to have a freaking dog in hell chance, you know, and it's just that great performance of just, like, the only time, really, where you, probably the WWE would be understandable if everybody started cheering for their heel, because it's just that kind of performance of just, like, yeah, he was like, he really was the underdog, even though, which is a bit weird role to have as a heel, which is probably the only thing that might fault it, really, is that the heel was an underdog in it. But
so how do you guys, I mean, that contributor there said it was one of his all-time great performances, or words to that effect, I'm sorry for not verbatim, how would you rate it compared to previous Flair efforts of, you know, from his NWA days?
Top 10.
I think one of the reasons it stacks up pretty well in a lot of respects is because when you look at that Flair run in the WWF, there weren't really many high points, were there? As we mentioned in the last podcast, I think it's a really good Flair performance. His best performance, no. I think you look at he was better in the Funk feud, all the stuff he did with the Horsemen. And, you know, you can pick out individual, you know, bits here, there, and everywhere, but I think there are better individual performances from Flair than the Rumble. But I certainly think it's
Flair's
upper echelons.
Flair's 1989 in particular is a pretty immense year with the Steamboat feud, the Funk feud. There's a lot of great performances. Again, in terms of like all time great performances, I do think it's very, very good. But I think a lot of it is the fact that, again, what Steve alluded to in the beginning, the fact that it was on what people do deep down all do consider the big stage, or at least if not the big stage, the enemy stage. We want our guy to do well if you're a hardcore NWA guy, and I think that does play into it a lot. I do think that Flair's performance is particularly great. It's begging off and being the coward for an hour and taking all the backdrops, it was great.
Would you say like the past experience of people like Dusty and Harley Race in WF when they went over, that kind of contributed as well, that maybe he hadn't had his head shaved and called Spartacus just quite yet?
The fact that they all maybe had lower expectations than, you know, People wanted the dream match with Hogan. People wanted the dream scenario of Flair being a top guy. Can he make it over there? And then not only does he actually get the kind of the royal red carpet treatment that those guys didn't get, but he goes over the whole company in one match.
Did he though? Because I'm trying to think back to the time, and this is obviously it's all retrospective, but at the time, I don't know if he was put across as a big deal to me as a young, naive, completely innocent wrestling fan. I don't think he did the stuff with the blurring of the belt and that, and it's hard for me to say, but just thinking back, I'm not sure he was really put in the position, cast as the star that people maybe assume he was in that position, you know, given the match, he wasn't the man, and he was put as
the underdog, because I mean, remember, like that 92 Royal Rumble was a stacked Royal Rumble. I mean, as I said, you had Hogan, you had Macho Man, you had Sid Justice, you had a lot of people in there who probably the audience thought was a more likely candidate to win. Like, Ric Flair was probably actually a little bit down the list.
Well, Carl actually said last week, he just flat out expected Hogan to get the belt back, and a lot of people, I assume, probably did.
I mean, as a Hulkamaniac at the time, I was disappointed. I'll tell you who wasn't disappointed. You mentioned about audiences and things of that nature last week, and we talked about New York a lot. The Albany crowd there at the end of that show.
Oh, yeah.
In a telling sign, boo Hogan and cheer Sid.
Yeah. Mm.
Didn't they, for months after, they sweeten that as well?
They doctored the audio so that people...
I've got it as part of the tagged classics, that it's the 91 and 92 Rumble, and it is sweetened, but you can still hear it. It's still audible.
Yeah.
Also, just before we finish on this Rumble thing, just as the chat base briefly mentioned, that post Rumble promo, which is just like
it's Gene Oakland is also great in that.
Oh yeah,
that cigarette out. The he brings to the promo is fantastic.
Yeah, I mean that entire promo. I mean, like, probably later on in the podcast, if it's mentioned, I'll go more into detail with the Flair Heenan perfect dynamic and just why it's one of the best things ever. But it was just a great way to kind of christen that title run with that kind of promo. And just like, Flair had better moments, yeah, in WCW, certainly did, but that was certainly the highest point in his WWF career.
Yeah, and the thing is, it was so complete a performance, because he got a lot of time in the ring, he got to bump himself with so many people, he went over, he cut the great promo, it was great. Tiger Rick, just to go back to his comments from the UK fan forum, for the bad, the SummerSlam undercard, what a collection of utter toss. Nails and Virgil is one of the worst matches I've ever seen. Michaels and Martel is ruined by the Sherry nonsense.
I can fuck that off.
We're not going to get too much into this, because we've had an argument on this podcast before between Carl and Chase debating the merits of Michaels versus Martel, so we'll leave that alone, because you don't want to cause any hard feelings.
We don't want to relitigate. No, okay.
Tatanka, Berserker, Shango, Matador, Kamala, ugh. The tag matches feel like they go on forever. Even Warrior Savage is a massive disappointment after WrestleMania 7. The experience of being there obviously hides a lot of this stuff, otherwise it would get royally panned more often. Carl, you were there in person for this show, so if there's anything that you would like to chime in here about being live at SummerSlam 92 to witness Nails v. Virgil.
I think I needed therapy after Nails versus Nurgle?
Nurgle.
Oh, screw it. Nurgle. He doesn't deserve to have his actual ring name mentioned.
The British Bulldog in the main
event. There we go. But I think he's absolutely right. The being there and the atmosphere involved, and having a major pay-per-view over in this country, you know, not your one night only being an enjoyable event that you were at, but they're very much cast off as B shows, aren't they? The rebellions, the insurrections, all that sort of thing. So to have a major pay-per-view there, and for it to be the Bulldog, means you do get caught up in the emotion. I think it did gloss over a lot of the card. Everyone, in truth, was there to see Bulldog, weren't they? I mean, my two abiding memories from that show were the main event for the IC belt and two entrances, funnily enough. Legion of Doom coming out on the bikes. Less said about Hawk the better. And the Taker entrance with the Hearst.
Yeah.
But in terms of the actual in-ring product as a top-to-bottom card, it doesn't stack up, and I think anyone who looks at it objectively can say
he's,
that.
I think it's a little bit stiff on the Warrior Savage rematch. I don't think it does hold up to WrestleMania 7.
I think in fairness to him, that's the point he's
making. Yeah.
Mania 7 was such a good match and went so far above people's expectations that a rematch later on with Savage being a bit beat up and Warrior having been away for quite some time could never really live up to the initial match.
Yeah, and I think from that perspective that is a fair point. He mentions for the Ugly the Boss Man in those photos after Nails battered him. Great selling of a great angle that went nowhere. Do you remember that the Boss Man pictures in WWF magazine where he's just beaten to fuck?
If I can jump in quickly, I remember I was on holiday at the time. A terrible holiday in Wales, in a caravan. But for some reason, we had a video recorder, and I taped the episode of Superstars where it happened.
That's a great day. I love that debut.
So my one abiding memory of that holiday, which was the absolute drizzling shits, was the Nails beat down of the Boss. And it's quite a, as far as legitimate looking attacks go, it's pretty damn good. Boss Man does a great job selling. Then you've got the magazine issue of a month or two down the line, we've got him pointing to the bruises and wrapped up and bandaged. It was a really great build to something that was I would say over too quickly, but anyone who's seen that Night Stick on a pole match should probably be thankful and view it as kind of a mercy killing, in truth.
Yeah, he says that it kind of went nowhere, but it was ultimately blown off at the Survivor Series, and that was pretty much the end of Nails. And Nails was supposed to go on to bigger things, ended up not so much being gone to bigger things.
Is that because he turned Vince down?
Yeah, well, according to him. Fanny Pack from the UK Fan Forum. The good, the Royal Rumble. I can't do it justice, but it's mentioned nearly every week on this forum because of what a ridiculously good pay-per-view it is, especially the match. I'm noticing a common theme here. The bad, the turnover of wrestlers in WWF that year. For example, that year's Rumble match was packed with big names. Every entrance seemed like a star. Fast forward to Survivor Series in 1992, Bret versus 1992 Shawn for the title just wasn't doing it for me. Shawn was just making his way in singles, he just won the IC title, and Bret was still a bit of an unknown in terms of title potential. Yeah, it was a bad time for me as a fan. Talent turnover, big deal with the WWF.
Is this probably the time to bring in the...
Well, before we get to that, which is coming up shortly, not to cut you off, but I know exactly what you mean. Just this point here about Bret being an unknown in terms of title potential does seem like a natural tie to something that I kind of wanted to talk about anyway, which is one of the bad points of this year is the execution of Bret becoming champion and Ron Simmons becoming champion, the hotshot of the mid-card guys.
You can certainly say that the execution for Bret wasn't excellent.
Indeed. So, I like what you did.
So, sorry, what was the exact quote he was using for Bret then that you just said?
Bret was still a bit of an unknown in terms of title potential.
An unknown in terms of title potential.
World title potential, yeah.
Yeah, well, isn't anyone who wins it for the first time?
Not necessarily.
No.
Not at all. In terms of like being a big deal.
Isn't everyone an unknown potential? They don't know how things are going to go when they give them the title.
I think you're arguing over semantics. I think the point being that there's no exposure given to him as a build-up to going for the title.
Yeah,
and then as a payoff. I mean, circumstances why the turnover of talent, obviously we'll come on to in a bit. Yeah, I think looking earlier, going over the history of the title changes, when probably started around the Survivor Series. I mean, so I might be wrong on this, but Survivor Series when with the Taker Hogan deal, then they switched it and flopped it
in 91.
In 91, yes, sorry. And then leading into the Rumble, obviously vacant, but then Flair gets it. Obviously, Flair then drops it in Saskatoon to Bret.
Yeah,
then
obviously he drops it to Savage. Savage gets it back.
Then
Flair gets it back.
Yeah,
sorry.
Flair gets it back on the TV taping after SummerSlam.
Yep.
It's just that the emphasis actually on the title is from being almost, I suppose, it's pinnacle Rumble time when they started switching, flipping it around. But over the course of that year, I mean, the value of the title, I mean, I remember at the time I had lost track. I didn't care if Bret Hart's not really a world champion. He's just, was it even real? I don't know. I think I didn't even believe people at the time when they told me.
Yeah.
Before I actually saw the TV that had happened. And Ron Simmons, you say, I think you want to talk about yourself, but in terms of actual elevation and position of new champions going forward, although to a lot of people this period of the elevation of smaller guys, particularly in WWF, was, you know, massive positive, in terms of actual creation of stars, maybe Vince was distracted, but it was pretty bad. Like, well, it really didn't give the guys the help that they needed in that position.
No, not at all. And yeah, it didn't take too long before they cut bait on both experiments, at least for the short term. Obviously, they went back to Bret. I should probably mention, actually, the great Rick Morris from the fdhlounge.blogspot.com for the bad mentioned extreme hot shotting of the top titles. Ron Simmons and Bret Hart never had honest chances at long title reigns because the people weren't conditioned to expect somebody becoming the world title before becoming a top guy. And I want to kind of talk about Rick's point a little bit here. Because in the case of Bret, obviously it was a reactionary move due to the fact that Warrior had been kind of, you know, ixnayed out of the company. Bulldog was gone as well, due to the growth hormone situation, and to the fact that, you know, he beat Flair on a house show in Saskatoon. It wasn't even televised. It wasn't built up. Bret was floundering. Well, he wasn't floundering before this, but there was no issue. It wasn't like he was building up to a big title match. It was a complete shock to the system, and the first time the WWF took a guy who was established in the middle and shot him to the top that quick. Usually they bought guys in to be a big deal. Obviously that was the case with Hogan, Savage, DiBiase, you know, the guys that people were used to being established stars. Warrior was, you know, smashed over everybody pretty much immediately. Bret was the first guy they took from the middle and thrust up top, and it didn't take.
Well, I think Kira mentioned there the term about sort of planning, and that was sort of the vibe I was getting. Correct me if I'm wrong about sort of the plans going forward for these guys to sort of give them the exposure. And I think you're right. It was very much haphazard, I think it's probably the best word I can think of in terms of the treatment of the WWF title at the time. I mean, most people's memories just prior to Bret winning the belt is still SummerSlam.
Yeah.
So you've got Bret Hart coming off a loss for the Intercontinental title. You've got Ric Flair, who is heavily featured around the Warrior Macho Man match, but doesn't have the belt and doesn't wrestle. Flair's got the belt back from Savage in something that was really underpublicized.
Yeah.
And then you've got Bret winning the belt from Flair, like you say, in a match that was even less publicised, which isn't even then transmitted on TV at a later date. And I was saying to Kieran off air that I believe the only way you could see the match up until sort of, you know, more recent DVD releases was on a VHS release by the company. And I can't remember the name, but I can tell from the smile on your face, I think you can.
Is it Smack and Whack'em?
Smack and Whack'em. I couldn't remember the name for the life of me, but that was the only way to see that title change for many years. And just think about that now, folks. It just that just wouldn't happen, would it?
But I mean, little tiny things as well, like as you alluded to at WrestleMania 8, where the title match wasn't the main event of the show. It was on at the middle part of the show. So it was like, it was dating back all the way right to WrestleMania, where like the title was just starting to get a bit kind of second-handed, really.
With regards to WrestleMania 8, it was obviously everyone in the company pretty much knew it was going to be Hogan's last appearance for a while. And you've got the return of the Warrior, so they wanted to tie that in. And as terrible as that Sid Hogan match is, and it really is terrible,
it's awful,
it would be hard for the WWF title match to then follow that with the return of the Warrior, in terms of getting the crowd up and all that sort of thing. You know, how do you follow that? And then obviously SummerSlam, it's the fact it's in England, it's the Bulldog, most of the fans in attendance are there to see the Bulldog. You can't put that match on any earlier than the main event.
Agreed. And just to kind of bring this point together when it comes to Ron Simmons too, who I mentioned there, that the whole point with Ron that I thought was just bizarre was the fact that they again, WrestleWar, which was the pay-per-view just before this,
yeah.
Obviously Great American Bash when Vader got it, but before that was WrestleWar. It was the Dangerous Alliance against the top five babyfaces in the company. Ron Simmons wasn't among them. They did do a little bit better of a job, I suppose, in kind of foreshadowing it by having Ron Simmons watch the Sting-Vader match at Great American Bash. Mm. But even then, it was the fact that he got it on a fluke by winning a lottery, the title match itself. And then even then, it was that immediate thing of taking a back seat to the more important angle. He's wrestling Barbarian at the atrocious Halloween Havoc pay-per-view, while Jake and Sting take the top prominent spot. Starrcade 92, he's in the middle with Dr. Death, while the King of Cable and the Battle Ball takes priority.
How long did he actually have the title for? How long? It was quite
about 6 months.
Yeah, it was about half a year, wasn't it?
It was a decent enough length of time. Liam, you can probably help me out with this one. The sudden win for Simmons, if you like, does that stem largely from the fact of a change in management?
Oh, of course it does.
You know, because I think he'd had a world title match prior to Watchman in with Luger, hadn't he?
Halloween Havoc 91 did the 2 out of 3 falls match with Luger and successfully.
Yeah. But I think obviously you've got what's coming in, so everything at that point is sort of thrown up in the air.
So it's not just
Simmons in that regard, but I think it's the management thing. I'm right in saying in terms of time frame there, aren't I?
Yeah, absolutely. Bill Watts came in right at the point of WrestleWar, and obviously his first big thing to do at Great American Bash was put over Doc, Gordy, and Vader as his big centerpiece guys. And the whole thing with Vader was, I mean, Vader's first run was ultimately transitional to get to Simmons because he wanted the big black babyface megastar.
He's trying to parlay his previous experience with the Junkyard Dog.
Of course, and it was done in such a hotshot fashion. It done so quickly, and Ron Simmons really wasn't given a fair shake when it came to actually being the top guy. Who knows whether or not he actually should have, but that's a different story for a different day. The whole point was, again, to go to Kieran's point, that the theme here is the devaluing of the world titles.
I just want to mention quickly about Doc and Gordy as well. I was thinking about this earlier. At the time, they were like the most fucking boring tag team, as for me. Just watching on Saturday afternoons on the ITV.
On Worldwide, yeah.
Yeah, Worldwide. So, I mean, yeah, I think the Heidi River on Worldwide is always, they were talked about and referred to, which did give them an aura, but they were so fucking boring.
I was thinking,
I watched these All Japan tapes. What the fuck is going on?
Yeah, it's night and day, and it's on earth do these guys not come off like they're great? That's the thing, that, I mean, and they had a very slow match with the Steiners. I think it was Beach Blast, too. They had like a 30-minute draw, I think, which was a little bit, it didn't really hit with me.
Was that a main event or one of them?
Yeah, it went on last on Beach Blast 92, Fanny pack for the ugly, in a shockingly good ugly way, The Rock is split at the barbershop.
Still probably
the most shocking thing I've seen in WWF/WWE, come to think of it. Just a brutal, ugly, nasty piece of wrestling brilliance. So all in all, my 1992 started off like the absolute clappers and ended in a whimper. The barbershop must be discussed.
As you're aware by now, folks, I like Shawn Michaels to an unhealthy degree, maybe. I love The Rockers. I was so pissed off when they never had the titles.
Yeah,
when this happened, this was the talk of the playground. It was.
Yeah.
I was so disappointed in Shawn. I was disgusted. I was more concerned. I just wanted them to get back together. I didn't want Marty to get his revenge. I just wanted him. And I was so disappointed. And then, I kind of fell out of love of Shawn for a while. And I think the next thing I remember, he taking the belt off Davey Boy after I give him my heart to Davey, and so me and Shawn really weren't getting along at this moment of time, but luckily we got over that. But god damn, that was just the greatest. I love that angle so much.
I just can't remember watching it at the time, because I was never the biggest fan of the Rockers when they were together. I was more of a Heart Foundation guy, I guess. When he did the split, even though I wasn't fond of the Rockers, I was at the time, I was kind of like, this is interesting, but I don't know whether this is going to end up being the best for Shawn Michaels. So I didn't know whether this was actually going to click with him being a singles guy, because I was so used to him being a tag team wrestler that I was a bit unsure. I just thought, oh, he's just going to be another of those guys that gets a little bit of a push and it fizzles out and he ends up going back to his tag team partner and that's going to be it. But for the time being,
you weren't thinking the term push when you were like,
yeah, it was not
6 years old.
Yeah, not term push. But you know, like the usual thing of, okay, in the children's form of, they'll fall out, and then in the end, he won't win anything, and he'll realize
they'll be friends after lunchtime.
Yeah, exactly. And he'll realize that he was much better off when he had his best buddy Marty with him.
Yeah, so I never thought they would get back together. Maybe that's the difference. See what he did to Marty. There's no way back from that.
With the glass.
For me, I never actually saw it at the time it happened, in truth. The first I was aware of it was actually reading it in the magazine.
Yeah.
You know, I remember that when WWF actually had a magazine. God, those were the days. But, so I didn't see it at the time. I just sort of saw the still frames, read the article about it. And it wasn't until about, you know, 2 or 3 months later that I actually saw it. And even then, you know, the kick was great, as you say. But even then, I was still shocked by the idea of someone going through a pane glass window.
Yeah,
because you never saw anything like
that.
It
seems so much more real than
and the way you've got
angles of that,
and you've got Jannetty just slumped over it as well.
Trickle of blood down the back of the hand.
Trickle of blood. It was very cinematic in some respects. I don't want to sort of go too overboard with superlatives, but it was a really well constructed turn.
It's just, maybe it was just a fluke because Marty didn't know where it was, but as well, there's a little...
There's a good chance of that with Marty.
Yeah, after they've kind of, you know, tend to reconcile and they've raised his hands, and Sean gives him a little pat on the stomach. Go that way.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, if you assume that Marty knew what was happening or remembered, it's like it just comes across as this malicious, like, oh, he's looking back, he's setting him up.
Setting him up the whole time, yeah.
Fucker, yeah. Brilliant.
Air Raid from the UK Fan Forum. The good. In general, US match quality in 1992 was superb. The Rumble has been talked about extensively, not least by myself, it's my favourite match, but the WWF churned out great matches all year long on TV and on pay-per-view. WrestleMania and SummerSlam each had a couple of belters on them, and even though Survivor Series may have seemed like a whimper to Fanny Pack, piss on that, the Hart Michaels match itself was excellent! We got a feud! I actually rate it as the best match they ever had together for storytelling. I could give you a couple of paragraphs about why that match is brilliant, but I'll rein it in. WCW also delivered big time in the ring. War Games at WrestleWar was obviously stunning and probably my second favourite match ever, but Super Bowl and Beach Blast were also chock full of great matches, and Sting Vader from Great American Bash was great too. A lot of positive here to talk about in terms of great matches. I do love some of these selections.
God bless Kip Fry's bonuses.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the noticeable one now is Beach Blast 92.
Yeah, I love that.
Now,
love that show.
This Beach Blast 92 is the match with Sting and Cactus,
yeah,
which is
Fork down anyone on the Gulf Coast.
Absolutely a fantastic match, and was for a long time Foley rated it as his best. And then the same pay per view, if I'm not mistaken, has also got the great match between Steamboat and Rude.
30 minutes.
The thirty minute Iron Man.
And don't sleep on Pillman Flamingo either in the opener. Oh, it's a really underrated match.
Trust you to get the Pillman one in there, but
of course.
But you are right. Sort of everything that you want from an opener for a show.
Air Raid for the bad said, probably a cop out to take a single match, but the first thing that came to mind was the Bushwhackers versus the Beverly Brothers featuring that turd Jameson at the Royal Rumble. Mentioned this last month, this is the dregs of this that otherwise good Rumble pay-per-view. Or
anything to do with the Bushwhackers.
LOD disasters wasn't great either. The ugly, the outside-the-ring scandals that rocked the WWF, leading to departures and downturn in business. This is something that has been waiting to be discussed all show, and you have to, because this is, if not one of the bigger themes, it might be the biggest theme of this whole year.
A tale of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Without the rock and roll.
This is really the meat on the bones. 1992, for some of the good stuff that we saw in-ring, which email has already alluded to, was a disastrous year from a PR perspective for the World Wrestling Federation.
and that's
putting it mildly. to give a bit of a background, obviously, in 91, you've got the Zahorian trial in which he's indicted and eventually sentenced to 3 years in prison for steroids or supplying steroids to wrestlers. Hulk Hogan's disastrous attempt at sort of damage limitation on the Arsenio Hall show, where he claimed to take steroids all of three times
in his life, only for medical rehabilitation.
So you've got a steroid issue that bleeds into 92.
Yeah.
All this against the backdrop of the World Bodybuilding Federation, so nothing ups the company image like a bunch of juiced up guys.
Yeah.
You've got ridiculous physiques, which people are now, whilst it was always been put to one side, people are now asking questions when they look at your Ultimate Warriors, Warlords. It's probably the only time anyone ever asked a question about Warlord in truth.
Sid. Can't ignore Sid.
Sid. So when you've got all this issue, the underlying current of steroids, which is bubbling up and just won't go away for the company. I mean, and as if that isn't bad enough, everyone in the locker room is apparently a sex-crazed maniac. And none more so...
Sex-crazed homosexual.
Sex-crazed homosexual maniac. And none more so than the employees who actually tend to reside within Titan Towers.
Yeah.
You've got allegations of sexual... I was going to say assault, but that's wrong. Unwanted sexual advances against Murray Hodgson, Barry Orton...
Tom Cole.
And probably the most damning one of all, a young ring boy, Tom Cole. As if this isn't bad enough, because we'll get to the fallout of the show.
But wait, there's more!
But exactly, but wait, there's more, because we will talk in more detail, I'm sure, about the disastrous shows that TV shows that followed from this scandal. As if those incidents weren't bad enough, the big cheese himself, the head honcho, Vince McMahon, was accused on a TV show, it was a one-off special.
Yeah.
Called... Wrestling's Ring of Vice, hosted by Geraldo Rivera, that man of journalistic integrity, in which Vince himself is accused of raping, in the back of his limousine, a former referee by the name of, and help me out, Liam,
Rita Chatterton.
So this is just a complete train wreck of a year outside of the ring for the company. And I'll let someone else jump in now with a bit more detail on not only wrestling's Ring of Vice, but also Donahue.
Yeah, well, I mean, this, like you said, and this all took place because the WWF just couldn't stop being full of shit, honestly. They invited a lot of negative media with the whole Gulf War angle dating back to WrestleMania 7, so the media was already not exactly thrilled with the WWF and whether or not this was really for kids, because it was making light of a very serious issue in their eyes. Hulk Hogan then proceeds to lie his ass off on the Arsenio Hall show, just flat out denying he'd ever done steroids, and who could ever possibly believe that? Vince McMahon then says, in light of the kind of the brouhaha that started from it, that the WWE had instituted a drug testing policy that was unbeatable, an unbeatable steroid policy, which to this day still doesn't exist.
So unbeatable that the majority of them were still on it.
Yeah, the lies just kept getting worse. And then when the sexual allegations started and Vince McMahon denied them, it just got worse and worse and worse, because as soon as it was denied and as soon as Hulk Hogan lied, all these people who had, whether they had access to grind or whether they were legitimate in their complaints about whether it was sexual harassment or whether it was, you know, drugs in wrestling, they all just dropped out of the sky and just fell right into the chairs on the Donahue set, with poor Vince McMahon and Dave Meltzer looking like the aforementioned Sky Flamingo with a fantastic moulet. Really just it was a train wreck of a show. Murray Hodgson, who just absolutely out McMahoned McMahon on Donahue, and ended up, I think it ended up, he was completely full of shit anyway, as it turned out. It was like,
so McMahon.
Yeah, McMahon. But it was just a disastrous turn of events. I mean, it was just one thing after another. We can't, being in Britain, this is one of the disadvantages of this, we can't really sense the full cultural impact in America. Although reading The Observer from those times, it's quite interesting, because business didn't necessarily take a direct hit because of this. While all this was going on, the Donahue show, Phil Mushnick, who must be mentioned for just absolutely ripping Vince McMahon a new asshole, comparing him to Hannibal Lecter in the New York Post. It was just, it was so bad. I mean, they made so many enemies, and the media, it's one of these horrible blanket statements, but they were not having a fun time. But in terms of cultural impact, massive black eye for the company.
I mean, there's no two ways about it. But interesting watching the Donahue show on YouTube earlier. Just in so many ways, an interesting social commentary from that show. But, I mean,
you could talk about this for fucking hours, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, I used to do a whole show just on
scandals of wrestling.
Just on the Donahue show, just analysing the back and forth beats of the conversations. But I think one of the overarching things, in terms of actual business, it's the questions from the audience at the end, when it's wrestling, it is a joke to them still.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the biggest... People don't care. It's a scummy... dirty business, and I think most people...
You either have time for it or you don't, and if you don't, then you're going to be like that woman at the end who, after listening to all of these allegations, just says, isn't wrestling fake anyway?
Yeah. I mean, like, all the way... Sorry, Carl. All the way during that Donahue show, I mean, the audience are laughing anyway. Just all the way through. I mean, like, probably not obviously all of them are wrestling fans, are probably just fans of not a fucking show. But it's just like, yeah, just the whole fact that, like, they're dealing with a very important, serious matter in terms of, obviously, sexual assault and so on. And they're just, like laughing their asses off. And Donahue's just there. And, you know, whether he's trying to be serious or not, he's there cracking freaking jokes about it and doing, like, little one-liners, trying to get the approval of the audience. And it's just like, Jesus Christ, this is probably who Jerry Springer modelled himself after.
Well, Donahue is very much playing the Pied Piper, if you like. I think the reason the Donahue show, to me, probably didn't have as much of a negative impact on the company as, say, the naysayers were hoping, is because, yes, Vince takes his lumps, and as you say, Murray Hodgson out McMahon's McMahon, but it does come across, much to everyone else's point, there's a bit of a joke where the audience are concerned. I mean, one woman I'm paraphrasing it, but it was something along the lines of, so how many homosexuals are there in wrestling as a percentage?
Yeah.
You know, it completely undercuts the seriousness of allegations being involved.
What the fuck does that matter?
Exactly.
Can you please give us the consensus? Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
But then on top of that, you've got some of the guests clearly come across as people who have axes to grind. And in that case, you know, to that extent, they lose a bit of credibility. I mean, Superstar Billy Graham, this has to be mentioned. He comes across as a feral dog, ranting and raving throughout his appearance, and coming out with ridiculous comments. Like, I think one that we didn't mention when we sort of viewed it, a bit of it earlier, was accusing Hulk Hogan of molestation of the mind.
Child molestation of the mind.
You know, so when people are coming out with outlandish remarks like that, it just serves to reinforce this sense of, it's a bit of a laugh and a joke. It's all a, you know, look, it's wrestlers being over the top as they are on TV. And it just, as I say, it undercuts any sense of seriousness to the issue. And it was an incredibly serious issue. And the only one who really brings any gravitas to me in a serious nature is Meltzer.
Yeah.
I was disappointed to see Bruno there, Bruno Sammartino.
I don't think you should be disappointed to see anybody there. It was a legitimate issue that deserved to be talked. Yeah. I mean, if Vince is there, anybody can be.
You know, there's a difference. Like, obviously, Dave Meltzer, you know, he was there, and he was a good choice to be there, because he was obviously a guy who's...
Neutral.
Yeah, he was neutral. Whilst Bruno Sammartino was, however he was trying to make it, like, played out, he was obviously just on the same side as Billy Graham, where he was just there just to rat on Vince McMahon, and just, you know, try and, you know, turn the screws as much as possible.
I don't think there's any suggestion from Sammartino he's there as Mr. Even-handed and calling it as he sees it. Everyone knows, with regards to Sammartino, prior to the Hall of Fame induction and the sort of the kiss and make up, if you like, Sammartino had an axe to grind. He didn't like the nature of the company throughout the 80s. He did have, you know, Sammartino was a clean living guy. He did have a big issue with the drugs in wrestling. And to the point of the Donahue show, it's not that the topic wasn't serious, as we say, and it's not that a lot of the people on the show may have had legitimate criticisms and legitimate points to make. It's just the way a lot of them went about it that did them and the topic itself a disservice.
Now, I say, in juxtaposition, you put my... I say, there's no two ways about the seriousness of the topic and the allegations, but on that format, on that show, it's watching it right here, right now. Vince, he's struggling, but he could have come across a lot worse.
I think. Well, the thing, and if you want to see him come across a lot worse, you should see him on Larry King the week before with Bruno, where he's just absolutely full of shit, and he's trying to get away with everything he can get away with. The black and white of, you know, there is no issue. We've got this settled. These are all lies. You know, the percentage of wrestlers in my company on steroids now is zero, which is a completely ridiculous claim to make. Especially in light of what would end up turning up with Sid, which we'll get to later on.
You know what? I'd argue all the bullshit that Vince, you know, came out to kind of defend the company, I completely understand. I mean, obviously, from a business point of view, and from, you know, defending his corner and understanding, but
it's deny till you die.
But at the same time, it's like when you watch him on that show, it's like the outside world looking at the employees of a circus bitching about the ringmaster, and it's this completely disparate, separate world. No one's going to give a fuck about it in a year's time, and say what you want, so you take the heat out of it right now. And then, you know, a year down the line, everyone will have forgotten about it. And yeah, time wise, it still they took the down period, but 96-7.
Well, I think to your, sorry to jump in there, Cambridge. I think to your point, you've summed it up nicely there, where you say, in a year's time, who's going to give a fuck about this? And I think the point should be made, from my perspective, people here may disagree, the issue of steroids had a much longer lasting impact upon the company.
It's a real difference.
Yeah, whereas the sexual allegations, they did sort of die away after a year.
Came in the way.
Okay, McMahon paid a hell of a lot of people off.
Yeah. But classic Meltz line about a lot of people that came out to talk suddenly were driving away from the scene in fancy cars because Vince paid a lot of guys off, I guess.
But by and large, as you say, a year afterwards, no one was talking about sexual allegations. Whereas in terms of the steroid issue, you look at the number of names in 92 that are with that company that by the end of 92 aren't there. Hogan takes a sabbatical. Davey Boy's gone by the end of the year. The Warrior's gone not long before Survivor Series. Kerry Von Erich disappears. The Warlord Chuck, and he gets two mentions. He disappears.
All you need to do on this is compare the Rumble 92, which we've talked about, to the Rumble 93, and that will tell you a lot about what happened
absolutely
to the
panel.
Patterson was back by then as well.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Patterson was back by SummerSlam 92, just to hammer home your point. And I think one of the sort of positives, if you like, or maybe unintended consequences, is that this all acts as a conduit to the new generation and the smaller, better workers, not with a massive monster physiques, but it helps get Brett and Shawn and the other guys the sort of the leg up, if you like, that, let's be honest, none of us can sit here and say, hand on heart, they would have got that without the steroid issue.
Yeah, and just to quickly go back to the point with the steroids as well, like all you have to do as well is look at everyone that was around in 92 and a little bit of 91 as well. Just look at the people who are performing on that show and actually do a consensus of how many of them are actually still alive.
Yeah, it's pretty sad. Some of those pay-per-views, WrestleMania 7 in particular.
Yeah, and not due to like old age either, folks. It's just
Bill Thompson from Pro Wrestling Only. For the good, Bobby Heenan and Gorilla Monsoon throughout the year, but mainly their Rumble match call. I don't care what misgivings others have with Gorilla or Bobby, I've always loved them as a team, and their Rumble work has always had a special place in my wrestling world. The bad Jimmy Garvin. Just awful in every regard the entire year, whether in the ring, doing vignettes, or simply breathing. Garvin managed to look bad all the time. Gee, you know my disgust of Jimmy Jam Garvin.
I don't think this is something that we need to restrict in terms of Jimmy Garvin to 1992. I think it pretty much just sums up Jimmy Garvin career-wise.
I fucking loathe Garvin in 92. He's a baby face. He's so obnoxious. I said this before, he's the creepy uncle that shows up at the wedding and grabs the bride's ass and thinks he's hot shit.
Yeah,
he
looks more like the guy who turns up to fix your plumbing and you decide to lock the door instead of letting him in. Just like, you know what, I'd rather have a blocked toilet than let him in.
The ugly Rocco. I'm not a fan of the Legion of Doom, but giving them a ventriloquist dummy as their new driving force was horrible in the way that only wrestling can be horrible.
Yeah.
What the fuck was that about?
I think it was a way to get to just piss off Hawk, wasn't it? Yeah. Or maybe they just legitimately thought it was a cracking idea.
I think they probably just wanted a third member that wasn't on drugs.
Forget what we said about the scandals. That really was the biggest indictment of 1992. I remember watching Mania 8 and being pretty bummed that Road Warriors aren't wrestling on the show. They're just doing the interview with me and Gene. I remember thinking, not having much of a knowledge outside of the company, thinking, who the hell is this guy they've brought out with?
Oh, Ellering?
Yeah, I hate Ellering.
They bring out Ellering.
Yeah, he sucks. He's worse than the puppet.
Oh, come on. He complimented those guys well, I think.
I thought the opposite.
That wasn't the point of the Road Warriors, man. The brief promos that they did do, just those little shouty ones, Animal will shout a little bit and then, Hawk will do the rudder rush. That's all they needed to do because it's all about the mystique of the Road Warriors, that there were these badasses. They didn't need some plain speaking guy turning around saying, we're gonna beat you up and all that stuff. That didn't need to be said. They had fucking spiked shoulder pads. Of course they were.
But Ellering was a big part of that prior to them going to the company.
He's a big piece in the puzzle. I lean more.
He was the daddy, that's why he looked out for them. But I
was really intrigued by, like I said, more of my understanding comes after the fact, but I was intrigued by who this guy was. And then they throw the puppet in.
Yeah.
And even as a child, I'm thinking, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah, it was rough stuff. Reznor from the UK Fan Forum. The Good, tuning in to what I thought would be another run-of-the-mill wrestling challenge around October, only for them to bring the new champion out onto the podium. I lost my shit at that. Very cool, as I love the Hitman at the IC title level, and so unbelievably surprising because I'd never saw anyone break the main event glass ceiling before. Those things just didn't happen back then, and it wasn't like he was threatening to be a contender in the run-up to it either. They weren't exactly going out their way to build his stock back up after the clean loss at SummerSlam. It was a great, important moment, and I remember it vividly. So he considers it part of the good, and there are a lot of fans who do see it as part of the goods, because, you know, obviously whether they're Hitman fans or whether it was just, you know, because it led to a change in the business that obviously was very good, because obviously brought on top is a good thing for
yeah,
it wrestling
whole,
fans.
It brought a whole generation of fans to interest in it. Maybe if not, at least it gave him someone to associate with. Bret Hart is a massive guy.
Did he still feel that way when it came to WrestleMania 9 though?
Well, no one was happy with WrestleMania 9 apart from one. Well,
let's not revisit WrestleMania 9.
That's a different podcast for a different
day. But at the same time, he does say, oh, he wasn't in a position to, and it was a complete shock, and it was out of nowhere. And so I think the points are still valid. It's just two sides of the coin, I guess.
Well, yeah, I think that's the point. It speaks to your earlier points, where I don't think any of us around this table are thinking, oh God, it's terrible that Brett had the belt and Brett was being sort of positioned as a top guy. I think the issue we have with it around the table is the fact that it just came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And he deserved to have it handled better than it was.
For the bad, Reznor says, Marty Jannetty fucking up and disappearing deprived us until November of what could have been and what would have been a great feud covering the guts of the year. It also left Sean floundering a bit without much to do. That, or seeing the natural disasters suddenly turn into a couple of cuddly, big, friendly dudes. I didn't even know what they were supposed to have done to change. It was fecking terrible stuff turning them babyface, and their prominence in that role ruined the division in 1992.
The natural disasters,
a more aptly named team, I can't think.
Absolutely. The funny thing is about their turn, I don't remember them doing anything themselves to turn either.
No,
from what I recall, they basically became babyfaces by default because Jimmy Hart pissed off.
Yeah. Jimmy Hart, they did the angle where Jimmy Hart, what was that? They gave their title shot
their
to Money Inc.
Their title shot to Money Inc. So Money the Natural Disaster didn't really do anything to turn babyface. The fans were never really with them at any stage.
Oh, they're fucking awful.
And that tag title run was just
mostly Typhoon.
I think you could expand that just the whole of 92 and just the whole division. I think like the whole tag team division in 92 was just absolutely atrocious. I mean, like, considering, you know, the high they went from, like, the late 80s with the Heart Foundation, Rockers, Brainbusters, and so on, just to, as you said, the Beverly Brothers and Bushwhackers. It was just, Jesus Christ, it was horrible.
Well, you've got to remember that the sort of the talent they lost, if you like, to an extent, I suppose. Obviously, coming through the late 80s and into 1991, you've got Demolition, who effectively, their time had probably come and gone. They'd reached their shelf life, but obviously Axe has to step away for health issues, so you're losing that tag team, you know, and Crush is never an adequate replacement. The Hart Foundation split up, the Rockers split up, and those are big gaps to try and fill.
Yeah. And with no offence to either of them personally, Money Inc. never really did it for me.
Oh, they made... If Gordy and Doc were boring, then Money Inc.
more boring, obviously.
Yeah, I always look at Money Inc. as sort of...
Maybe if they have better teams to work with.
Yeah, maybe. I always look at Money Inc. as sort of almost DiBiase's swan song, if like, because he's got the bad back, and it's sort of the one last sort of prominent role for him before he steps away from the ring. So I've never really hated Money Inc. or anything like that, but like you say, it's just a bland.
They're just there.
Yeah, I'm not offended by it.
That's what I was always kind of confused by, like when the Steiners came in, because they kind of came in just before I kind of stopped watching. But like looking back on it retrospectively, with the Steiners coming in, I mean, you can understand like why Vince brought them in, because he needed someone. He needed like someone who was good in that tag team division. But you have to kind of, besides the obvious issue of money, why the Steiners went to WWF when like the division was so poor?
Wasn't it because it's around the time where it was when
Scott Steiner did not get along with Bill Watts at all?
Yeah, Watts obviously favoured Doc and Gordy, and that so they were their bitches. And
did they
go back to Japan first and then to WWF?
There was a little bit of, well, they were still kind of working for Japan anyway the whole time. Yeah. So Gary Thompson, for the good, Rumble 92 or WCW Battle Bowl, this being in Starcade 92. For the bad, I think the height of the WWF steroid scandal was back then. For the ugly, Ultimate Warrior versus Papa Shango. Before we get to Papa Shango, Battle Bowl thoughts?
I always just found that the Battle Bowl events and sort of the WCW at that time, when they're throwing a lot of things at the wall and trying to see what sticks, and it was all just, it was far too contrived for me.
Yeah.
I don't know if those are thoughts that are shared by the table.
There is the great Sting-Vader match on that Starcade, which is just fantastic. Okay. Where Sting gets his win back from Great American Bash, and the second of three fantastic pay-per-view matches they were doing in within the space of a year. It was a very interesting choice to have Muta win. I was always a little bit curious about that, because he didn't really go on to do much in 1993 of importance for WCW. But anyway, Steve Williams, Ron Simmons match for the title in the middle of the show with a cheap count-out finish, just further devaluing that belt. Otani's jacket from Pro Wrestling Only. The good WCW's Dangerous Alliance era produces probably the best period for television wrestling in company history, barring the NWA years. Negro Casas jumps to the CMLL, and we finally get to see him work on a regular basis, including a legendary feud with El Dandy. 90s All Japan Women comes of age with their November Dream Rush show. We'll touch on the other aspects if they come again, but the Dangerous Alliance needs some airtime.
Yeah. Definitely, yeah. This is a highlight for me from a retrospective standpoint, because I didn't catch much WCW. So as a kid, I didn't watch the Dangerous Alliance at a young age. So this is all like watching it back and wishing that I'd watched it as a kid, like in certain type of heels like Macho King and Razor Ramon. I think I believe I would have loved something like the Dangerous Alliance with Rick Rude, who I did like, and Steve Austin. I mean, this group, I'd actually state this is probably one of my favourite factions of all time. Probably the joint with the Four Horsemen, and also one of the pre NWO, one of the best angles they ever ran.
I like the Dangerous Alliance. I think it was criminal the way it was so short lived. There really was more mileage to it. But I hate Larry Zbyszko. Larry Zbyszko.
Shut up!
I can watch 20 minutes of stalling anywhere.
He wasn't so bad.
Zbyszko was alright.
This is the thing, okay. Despite the fact that he looks like a chubbier Bill Murray at this stage of his
Jim
career.
Belushi.
Yeah, that's not a bad comparison either. I dig Larry Zbyszko in this period of his career.
Him and Arn
fucking great.
Yeah, him and Arn Anderson together were a pretty solid tag team.
I'll be defensive of Zbyszko here.
Yeah. I mean that group in obviously Paul Heyman, just like a huge mark for Paul Heyman anyway. Obviously loving Rick Rude, Austin, Dad, Bobby Eaton, just everyone that was in it. Even like Medusa had a great role in this. And I think the reason why
she was there,
and they actually used her pretty well, considering that she was basically an assistant manager. The reason why I like that entire angle, because one, it started off based off something that was real. Which was Paul Heyman's disagreement with, probably to put it bluntly,
with WCW.
Yeah. And so, like Paul Heyman likes to do, he uses real life situations to fuel a feud.
What did he do? He was a commentator, was it before that?
Okay, so basically, Lex Luger was the champion, the WCW champion at the time, and because Flair had gone to WWF and they were doing the whole champion versus champion thing, or at least that's what WCW thought, they were looking around for other champions to do their own unification of their own real world champion, and Jerry Lawler was in talk to go to WCW and wrestle Lex Luger. Eddie Gilbert knew about it because he was working closely with Lawler, and obviously he was best friends with Paul Heyman, so Heyman probably caught wind of it. But it kind of, it kind of leaked out amongst a few industry insiders, and Heyman was the one that got the blame, despite the fact that the few industry insiders, no one knew, the fans didn't know, and if they did, it would have been a minor thing. So they made a mountain out of a molehill because they were pissed. And as it turned out, all things were resolved.
What they would do is have singles matches, tag matches, six-man tag matches, just varied it up, just entertaining across at least three of the matches on the show. And the reason why I love this angle so much is because, and why as a faction as well, is because when you take a lot of factions like the Four Horsemen, the NWO, the DX, and so on, after a while they all fizzle out. There's all that time period where like they kind of almost overstayed their welcome, as they were like they're absolutely getting the last juice out of the chicken. The Dangerous Alliance ended like almost pretty much on its high. It ended whilst it was still really good.
It ended like an angle, not like a typical faction.
Yeah. It just kind of ended on a high, so it doesn't have that bad stigma of it outstayed its welcome. The War Games itself, being for me the best war games WCW ever did. You know, whether it's just like the little details of how they all walked out, you know, to the ring, or like all regimented, like military
single file,
just single file, looking like fucking badasses. And then Paul Heyman, or Paulie Dangerously here, he has like his freaking plan sheet, and he's like pointing to everyone, telling them what they're gonna do.
His blueprint.
This, oh, you're gonna do this. You're gonna take that person over there. Then you're gonna come and do this. And it was just like just something a little bit different to the usual group cage matches that you see over there. And you know, just the talent involved, and also on you know, the Sting Squadron side with, you know, Sting and Dustin Rhodes and so on. It was just a great match, and with a good finish, a believable finish, an intriguing finish, that eventually kind of ended the angle.
Ended the dissolution of the group. Out of the Dangerous Alliance, just because WCW was in a really shitty position at the end of 1991. Sid left, Flair left, Luger was champion, and he was looking for the first lifeboat off the sinking ship. Yeah. And in the remnants of this, they took all the guys who were actually good, put them all together as heels. They got Steamboat back, which is a lovely shot in the arm for him. Dustin came into his own little bit. Barry Windham looked great. Von Simmons was getting in there on these tag matches. Sting got, you know, some new life breathed into him because he had some decent opponents to go against. Really good for WCW. Otani's jacket for the bad says, wrestling hits a low in the US with the steroid trial. Peña's AAA deal with Televisa ends the golden era of 1989 to 1992 Lucha. And Jumbo Tsuruta becomes ill. This is the year when Tsuruta gets hepatitis. His career pretty much got cut off at the pass at that point. And for the ugly, Ultimate Warrior versus Papa Shango, which we mentioned before with Gary Thompson, we didn't get into. So Papa Shango, thoughts around the table around Papa Shango. When we were fans, when we were buggers, what was your impressions of Papa Shango when he first came on the scene?
As a child, he absolutely terrified me. So it worked to that extent. It did sort of, you know, I wasn't jumping over behind the settee and cowering under the cushions or anything like that, but it did sort of, you know, did make me a bit edgy, you know, for, you know, and it all seems ludicrous to look back now, but it really did. With regards to the feud itself, even as a kid, I wasn't a big Warrior fan. You know, when you grow up, you fall into that category of you're sort of a Warrior fan or you're a Hogan fan. I was a Hogan fan, and throughout '92, I'm sort of thinking, where's Hogan? Is Hogan coming back? What's going on? I don't know that he's lied on the Arsenio Hall show. I don't know that he's taken a sabbatical to, you know, jump out of this PR disaster. All I know is that Hogan's not there, and I'm wondering if he's coming back. So they bring the Warrior comes back. I'm thinking, it's not Hogan. I never really liked the Warrior. Why is black goo coming from people? It all seemed, you know, as sort of intimidating as I thought Papa Shango was, the feud still seemed ludicrous to me.
The music and the mannerisms and all that stuff with Papa Shango. It did come up. Yeah. Kieran, what did you think about Shango at the time?
This is a tough one because you got to try and not look retrospectively. Thinking at the time, he was more notorious, I think, amongst like my friends. Like, oh, what the fuck is going on with this? Someone was sick, or what's that black shit coming out of his head? Maybe a little bemused as a child. I don't know.
Honestly, when I was younger, and I remember, you know, the Papa Shango stuff going on, I just remember there's like this weird kind of word of mouth of what was happening. But maybe these things like setting the jobber's feet on fire, which everyone remembers. Wally being sick and thrown up on somebody, the black goo coming from Wally's face in the interview. It's like, well, it just seemed so bizarre. It sounded so weird. It's like, as much as some people do like the Papa Shango character or don't like the angles or whatever, the ratings tanked. I mean, there was a massive, massive decline in ratings when that Warrior-Shango feud started getting as preposterous as it did.
I think it was more, I was probably too young to be embarrassed by it myself, but I was aware that older kids probably mocked it a bit.
Yeah, I kind of got that feeling
it
as
was
well.
Just, I can't really remember, because I know wrestling was fake back then. I think I always did, but it was one of the things I didn't care about.
Yeah.
But when you got people openly mocking something and questioning, and maybe that's a bit too much kind of thing, that's a bit too wacky, then yeah, that kind of bleeds over. It's like,
I can imagine the adult audience was just completely alienated by this.
Yeah, I think it's one of those where, I suppose even as a kid, it makes you a little bit embarrassed to be a wrestling fan. Cause it's the one that everyone, because like you say, I think in the back of our minds, we all know that it's not on the level, it's not on the up and up. But you don't care, you suspend your disbelief. But when you get something that's that hokey and that far-fetched, and you do have your friends mocking, you know, I can remember it's going, oh, you big baby, you're still watching wrestling and all, you know, all that sort of bollocks that comes with being a fan. You sort of, you know, you take those lumps. But it was one of those that made you, slightly embarrassed and sort of very sheepish about admitting you were a wrestling fan. One thing I would say that always struck me about that feud, as short-lived as it was sort of the, I suppose it wasn't really physical interaction because it was the black goo again, but the way that Gene Okerlund was sort of physically affected in a storyline. You know, you never saw that, did you?
Yeah.
Mean Gene just did his interviews on the podium and, you know, the guy would say his piece and he would leave. And yet you've even got Mean Gene involved where he's got the black goo coming down his hand and his hand's shaking and it's all just... That always struck me as quite surreal, seeing Mean Gene really involved in that level.
Petey from Pro Wrestling Only. For the good, the Dangerous Alliance angle culminating in one of the great War Games matches ever. Bad, 103-year-old Cowboy Bill Watts replacing Kip Fry and taking WCW back to 1977. This was a major turn. Wrestle War. Okay, War Games. The Dangerous Alliance goes down. Cowboy rides in on his horse, docks everybody's pay about 50%, takes away the mats.
Takes away the top rope.
Takes away the top rope. A lot of changes to the product, and not for the better. There was one great Bill Watts... Yeah, there's a few decent Bill Watts productions. Obviously, Beach Blast 92, that we mentioned before. Yeah, Great American Bash with Vader going over Sting is great. The TV episode where, you know, Jake Roberts debuts Ron Simmons into the belt. It's a very dramatic piece of TV. But on the whole... Not a good thing. It seemed like WCW was picking up a little bit of steam in there at the beginning of 1992, and it just went straight to hell.
Yeah, it wasn't a turn for the better. It's that classic example of a guy who used to know what made the business tick and probably still had something to contribute, but by and large, he was stuck in a bit of a time warp. The business had moved on. Archaic things like taking away the blue mats. What does that really... That does nothing for the business. That's just your sort of... Your philosophy, if you like.
Darkening the, you know, the lights in the building.
Darkening the lights. Taking away the top rope when you've got the likes of Pillman involved, Too Cold Scorpio, Juice and Thunder Liger is coming in. It's criminal to do that sort of thing. And Bill can try and justify it with his old, you know, diversion of the referee and all that thing. That's far too convoluted. It was a mistake to do. I think Bill's defence, by and large, has always been that he was brought in to bring the bottom line down.
Yeah.
You know, the bottom line did improve, but the TV ratings didn't. the buy rates didn't. They all went down. And he pissed off the locker room with sort of the Ten Commandments of Bill Watts,
yeah,
which led to the likes of the Steiners leaving in the first place.
Yeah.
Was the... this is a story I heard. I've read today, I'm not sure if it's true, that when they decided to reinstate the top rope deal, they made the decision, but then they said, asked the fans to get like a hotline vote.
Yeah, yeah.
Charge them like $5 to vote on it. Yeah. They're all going to vote for it anyway. Yeah. So they just fucking... Oh.
This was the era where the hotline scams really started to fucking pick up some steam. And for the ugly, Pete mentioned the Survivor Series buy rate. Buy rates plummeted massively with the absence of Hulk Hogan, SummerSlam 92 in particular, and then obviously, yeah, well, that was the first one after Hogan had left, and then Survivor Series just dropped even lower.
Well, that was the thing. When we were talking about the scandals earlier, you mentioned about the fact that WF business didn't take a hit immediately.
No. You know, it was the domino effect.
But it was the domino effect, and it, obviously it wasn't just Bill Watts' WCW that suffered, it was Vince's WWF, and the telling thing there is the fact that the buy rates dropped off because Hogan had left.
Yeah.
You know, it all snowballs. Hogan wants to get out of the way because of the scandals and all the bad PR. And that's when the company really starts to feel it. And it goes back to the earlier points about the likes of Brett and Sean not being positioned. And, you know, sorry, it's not been hinted at. You haven't seen the trajectory for those two. It's all just abrupt. Hogan's gone. And the fans haven't helped to be conditioned to see these people as equals.
Yeah. JCMMNX. There's a mouthful from the Wrestling Forum. For the good, to your point, Chase, the Dangerous Alliance, one of the best in-ring stables of all time, managed by Paul the Goat Heyman. Greatest of all time. Rude and Arn were at their peak. Eaton and Zabisco provided veteran leadership, and you had the young stud of the group who just happened to go on to be one of the biggest stars ever. Those five, with Sting, Steiners, Pillman, Steamboat, Cactus, Vader, Windham, and Rhodes, made this one of the best in-ring rosters ever.
The roster that WCW had at that time, you're kind of almost wondering why they didn't do better. Why didn't that roster get over or improve the business as much as it should have?
I think probably the answer is why WCW wasn't affected as much in the immediacy by the scare
they
of
weren't
drugs.
On the
because
radar.
They weren't main, the yeah, radio. They weren't main, main, weren't yeah. mainstream, yeah. especially that's the New York press.
Pete F3 from Pro Wrestling Only, the good killer feuds involving small time promotions, specifically the Moondogs versus every babyface in the USWA, Tenryu and War stirring shit up in New Japan towards the end of the year, and the AJW versus JPW feud leading to Dream Rush, probably the best wrestling card ever. That's a little bit of a push, but I do love the Bull Nakano Aja Kong match. On that show where Aja Kong pins Bull Nakano with her own finish move, no less, to pretty much end a 2 year plus feud. Mm. I will say for the USWA, he mentions the Moondogs there, and there were some great promos from Eric Embry in the USWA during this year, but the thing that I've got to mention from the USWA is Eddie Gilbert. If anybody's seen this, this might be my suggestion for the week to go watch on YouTube, is the Jerry Lawler Eddie Gilbert feud from the USWA. I think it's like May, June time. To build up the unification match between the global belt and the USWA championship, where and there's a great promo where it's been alluded to that Eddie Gilbert obviously was kind of obsessed with Jerry Lawler and had that kind of overwhelming fondness for Lawler, and they did this great promo where it's like the contract signing for the title match, and Lawler basically just says there's all these guys who have come and gone like Harley Race and Haku who have always wanted to be Jerry Lawler and always wanted to be the king. The difference between them and Eddie Gilbert is Eddie Gilbert actually wants my crown and he wants my robe. He wants to be Jerry Lawler. And then Eddie Gilbert, who's standing the whole time, looks as calm as can be and then just fucking snaps and just goes crazy, chokes him out and threatens to kill Jerry Lawler on television. And there's another great one where Lawler is talking about how Eddie Gilbert in real life was married to Missy Hyatt. And he goes, one night, Missy Hyatt was lying in the bed, she was all dolled up, Eddie Gilbert comes into the room, crawls into bed, turns around and puts one of my tapes in the VCR. Fantastic stuff from Lawler. Go and watch that, kids. The Bad, the WS attempts at pushing Papa Shango, the Berserker, and Nails as major heels feuding with the top baby faces. I like some of Shango's antics, but he turned off a lot of longtime fans, especially when the Warrior puked on an EMT. Berserker was impossible to take seriously as a threat, but was basically harmless. Nails, despite a fairly hot debut and a workable idea, was a disaster. You talked before about Papa Shango terrifying you as a kid. Nails scared me shitless.
That voice could give a child nightmares for years.
Yeah, I think it did. And for the ugly, there's a lot less ugly than in 91 or 93. However, Global had some stuff that was so undignified that it made Papa Shango and Nails look like something out of old Japan. The Rude Dog, Sebastian, Manny Villalobos' broke gimmick, Mike Davis, etc. 92 was not a good year for the Global. Fly on the Wall from Pro Wrestling Only. The Bad, the lack of Hogan in the WWF was felt pretty deeply throughout the year. Making Savage the top guy made more sense in 88 than it did here, and Warrior looked ragged and was held down by the Shango feud until he was in a better position by the summer. Randy Savage's title reign in 1992 was kind of it's kind of passed over so far when we're talking about the world title, but it really didn't. It didn't really seem like it clicked in 92 when he got the belt back at Mania.
No, I don't think it did. I mean, I've always been a big fan of Savage's in-ring work, Savage's promos. I've always been a big fan of Savage, but it seemed very much like if Hogan's not going to be there, as much as we've talked about sort of the lack of emphasis on the new guys that they eventually did push, if it's not going to be Hogan, you kind of sense that that's the trajectory they need to go in. So when you go back to the guy that was the number two to Hogan through the 80s, it's never going to stand up in comparison.
As a Savage fan, Chase, what were your thoughts on this at the time?
Joy. primarily, obviously.
Unabashed
joy of him winning at WrestleMania 8, obviously. Because, again, this is just down to just general opinion. I mean, you must have thought, Hogan was obviously the man, and Ultimate Warrior was the good, replacement, and Savage was just a distant second guy at one time in the 80s. Watching it was the opposite way around. It was just Macho Man was always the guy for me. He was always the number one guy, and Hogan and Ultimate Warrior didn't like not like him. I did like both of them, but they were just like there. They were just there. That were just like when Savage wasn't around for me, it was just like, well, Hogan and Ultimate Warrior then will win the title, and like that's just like how my perception was as a child.
I can completely understand that as a perception with it being your favorite wrestler.
Yeah,
but I just think perception. Generally speaking, is always that Hogan was the man, and I'm not saying Savage didn't deserve his due. He absolutely did, but it just it didn't translate well when you've got Hogan going and you're going back to someone else.
Yeah.
You can't keep going back. At some point, you have to move forward, and that was the time to do it.
Well, you're not going to move forward if you're just going to give the title back to Hogan,
which is what they did the next year. That's the problem.
Yeah, and that speaks to my point. They gave the title back to Hogan, and it did nothing.
Arrogantly grateful from Wrestling Forum for the good SummerSlam at Wembley. Not only was this the biggest SummerSlam crowd, actually the biggest crowd in the company history, if I'm not mistaken, in terms of legitimate attendance. Another thing I do want to mention that really does deserve some love that I feel is completely underrated is Tito Santana's match against Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania. Tito really carried this match well and dominated Shawn, even though Shawn got his win, but I thought Tito made him look really good and is truly underrated also, especially for his in-ring work with his flawless. If you want to go back and watch this match, I think you'll see exactly what I mean.
Carl's gurning.
I like Tito's work. It was completely the right decision to go with Shawn for, you know, in terms of that match, but I really don't think that's anything to write home about.
The match itself.
I mean, if you watch it, a lot of that match is, you know, the first 5 minutes or so, we're stuck in a headlock spot on the mat where it's the roll into the two and back to the headlock. I mean, it has a nice little finish at the end. Shawn sells well from what did Santana?
El Paso del Monte.
Yes.
Del Muerte, not El Monte.
Did I say Del Monte?
Yeah.
I really want some orange juice. but no, it was maybe a nice little sequence to sort of end the match, and it helps facilitate Michael's character going forward for him to get the win. And credit to Santana for not having that much of an ego where he can say, "Yeah, I'm going to put over the younger guy who's coming from tag wrestling." You know, how many times do we hear in the business of people that would just refuse to do the job flat out? And Tito's never been like that, so credit to him for that. But I think if you watch that match back, it really is nothing to write home about.
Just remind me in case I'm just wrong. That was the opening match, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's an opening match. Did the emailer start with talking about SummerSlam at Wembley?
Yeah.
I say probably deserves talking about. I'm sure they'd penetrated into Europe before then. Obviously, they had. That's why they came over. But in terms of being setting the stage maybe for international business going forward,
for years to come.
Yeah, and really creating a groundswell of young fans, Bret Hart fans, Bulldog obviously as well, but particularly I think Bret, people of maybe 25 years old and like yourselves, sticks out well. I think basically what it did, create that framework and foundation for its success overseas, which probably carried through some of the tougher times financially for years to come, and obviously going forward today when the network gets released in Europe as well. It's kind of
eventually
maybe the eventual goal of what he started back in 92. Maybe an argument can be made.
But for the bad, Arrogantly Grateful mentions probably the Ultimate Warrior's departure from the company at the time, and the British Bulldog too, considering he just won the IC title that year at SummerSlam. I also feel they should have done more with Mike Jannetty and Shawn Michaels' situation, especially when you think about how great it was when they split previously on the Barbershop. This may go again to that kind of apprehension, similar to what you mentioned with the Warrior, about a guy who got arrested at the start of the year and was shit-canned. Came back on that great angle with Sherry where he accidentally smashed the mirror over Sherry's head to set up his return for Shawn Michaels. But again, it did seem like they really kind of... It was a little bit of a flat thing by the time they finally got to Marty and Shawn.
Yeah, very much so. I think we talked, or an email, I should say, mentioned earlier about his view that the Boss Man Nails feud didn't really go anywhere after a hot start.
Yeah.
I think Jannetty Michaels is the more apt description for that.
Yeah.
You know, we've got the great angle at the barbershop that we've all talked about. You have to wait so long because of Jannetty's recklessness.
Yeah.
And it's a feud that you never, you know, it sort of bleeds into 93 and you never really get the payoff to it.
Yeah, they do at the Rumble where Shawn wins.
Yeah, but they even sort of went further with it on Raw, didn't they? And sort of,
in 93?
They Michaels always seemed to sort of gravitate back to Jannetty through the first half of 93 and there never really was a payoff to it.
So for the Ugly, he mentions quite a bit of their talent went that year, which was a shame. Also, seeing as we're talking 92, I think you need to give some honourable mentions in your podcast. You need to give a good bit of discussion to each of these, and he sent a couple of pictures of the Slam Jam Wrestling album and WrestleMania the album, if you recall these two. I don't even know what you could even call them, if you've heard these things. Smells like Teen Spirit,
mistakes.
It ain't.
Mistakes are what you call them.
Did you own this?
I own Slam Jam.
I knew it.
My sister bought it for me, and I played it relentlessly, I'll admit it. But at this point, I think it's only fair that we apologise to any American listeners on the podcast, because this was actually one of Simon Cowell's first forays into the music industry. This and I believe it was Mighty Morphin Power Rangers.
It was two big hits.
We were two big hits for Simon Cowell, which all snowballed to the point we've reached now with X Factor and what used to be X Factor US and all the contrived bullshit that goes along with it. So to any American listeners, consider this on behalf of everyone here, a mea culpa.
Also sorry for BP, but whatever.
That album, I don't want to pick on any one particular. No, well, actually, the Mr. Perfect song on the I think it's the WrestleMania album, where the song is like this really just terrible beat with Kurt Hennig just saying Mr. Perfect rhythmically about 50 times in a row. Do you remember that song?
I've been trying to.
Oh, it's dreadful. All right, Tim Evans from Pro Wrestling Only. Good, 992 was USWA's best year since probably the mid-80s. The Moondogs Lawler feud really helped spike interest in the group. Then you had guys like Brian Christopher and Eric Embry having good feuds and being really entertaining. Also, WCW was having great matches week in and week out with the Dangerous Alliance. For the bad, Eric Embry getting injured and then turning babyface to face the Moondogs. The babyface turn was good, but it didn't last long, and then he had the career-ending injury. Also, the Moondogs Lawler feud went on too long, and it started including guys like Big Black Dog and the King Killer. Yeah, it was really stretched out by the end of 1992. Eric Embry's heel turning babyface promo with Jarrett and Lawler stands out as a particular high. Snitsky's back acne from the UK fan forum. The bad. Halloween Havoc's main event stipulation was the ultimate letdown, and Jake's WCW stint was prematurely ended. Mention has to go to the fire match from FMW that looked amazing in magazines and is an incredible spectacle on video, but was a mess of a non-event to see. Halloween Havoc and the coal miner's glove.
Well.
Who would like to jump in first and talk about the old vignette, you know? Spin the wheel, make the deal.
Yeah. Come on, come on,
kill. Make the deal. Yeah.
The vignette.
was this, can I ask, if I'm not mistaken, this was WCW's first attempt at that sort of vignette?
Yeah, this is the mega movie era.
Going into 93, they do more of the mega
Castle
movies.
Of Fear, the White Castle, the Beach Blast, the evil, Calamity. The,
shot on film.
Yep, so the evil midget. Lost in Cleveland. Not to be confused with Cheeks. Lost in Cleveland and all that sort of stuff. But I think this was the first one that they did. And can you just imagine they're sitting around a table? This was Dusty's idea, right?
Yeah.
Dusty comes out with this abomination. You know, they should have known they were on, you know, the road to ruin. when this was a good way to promote a feud between Roberts and Sting. And it's an interesting one with Jake Roberts in 92, because you've got that strange scenario where obviously he holds up Vince for his release going into Mania 8 and, you know, does the favours for Taker on the way out. And then, because Jake has said this, I'm almost inclined not to believe it, but Bill Watts being Bill Watts and everyone else telling the stories they have about him, obviously Jake gets shafted on the contract.
Well, he says...
So he claims.
Until he says that he was going to make $3 million until Watts came along, which come on.
You know, it's Jake for... It's Jake before accountability crib, folks.
Yes.
So, you know, you tie that in with the, I think... He like another one he claims where Cheryl said it's me or the business, isn't it? So his running WCW is over before you know it. Now, the reasons for his departure, I'm not quite sure I believe the wife's story, to tell you the truth. But it seems like that was a real missed opportunity, because you think Jake could have had give some real sort of impetus to that company going into going into late 92 in what was a sort of a doldrums period. You know, here's the shot in the arm that doesn't happen.
And Halloween Havoc did do a very good buy rate. So
they cut expenses, but still
paid all that money.
Paid for those fucking videos.
I know, boggles the mind. Bad news, Gertner from TPWW. The good, Sting versus Vader at the Great American Bash 92 was awesome. Better than Bulldog versus Brett. Thoughts on that comment?
If you're a WCW fan, then yeah, you probably would lean more towards that. But he's talking about the one where Vader wins the title.
Yeah.
The shocker, yeah. Yeah, so I thought it was a really good match.
Honestly, I can't really say against Bulldog, because it was Bulldog and it was in England. And
yeah, we were going to be a little bit slanted, especially from our perspective at the time.
And the magnitude of it with Wembley plays a part. I think in terms of just sort of looking at them sort of as pure matches, I don't like to cop out, but it's been so long since I've actually seen the Vader Sting. It's been a long time, so I don't think I'm in the best position to judge them solely as matches.
The Bad. WrestleMania 8 felt like a mess, a combination of wrestlers long overstaying their welcome and the much-anticipated Hogan versus Flair match never happening. That's actually quite a big deal that you haven't mentioned yet. It's the fact that Flair was brought in seemingly for this match with Hogan. They did the match on the house shows in 91, and by the time 92 came around, they had no interest in the match, and even though it may... Yeah, I mean, the idea for Hogan and Sid was actually proposed long before Hogan was actually going to fuck off.
Well, didn't I don't know whether these facts are true or not, but didn't it? Because I'm going to say anyway. But when
does
the
like
same
Vince.
It does, doesn't it?
they're McMahon facts, folks.
Yeah.
And in the end, aren't those the real facts?
When they tried the Hogan Flair on the house shows, was it because it didn't draw well or it got like poor performances or something? That the reason that they backed out of it?
There was, if I'm not mistaken, they wrestled on a house show at MSG. And it didn't draw particularly well, and it seemed to spook the company.
Yeah, they did the loop, the first loop, and it did do well the first time. Maybe not as well as expected. I think people had like higher expectations, Flair coming in, but because, like you said, the MSG one was the one that really spooked Vince, and I think after that they held back on Flair a little bit when it came to Hogan.
Also, the other point in terms of like what was the eventual main event. Whether to confirm whether this happened or not, but did they do something when they signed Sid Justice that they like Vince promised him the main event against Hogan,
and then they got Flair after that, which really kind of screwed things up.
I suppose with Vince's logic regarding Hogan and Flair, he's obviously going to be thinking, if this can't draw a great house in my in my home arena of MSG, it's not going to do well going. Sort of outside the box, go to the Hoosier Dome in Indianapolis. So you can kind of see the logic there. Whether or not it was flawed logic is another matter. And obviously the Sid situation sort of muddies the waters. But with regards to Mania 8 as a whole, because I think it's something that needs addressing, it's a card that has two really good matches. The IC title match with Flair and Piper is great. I even enjoyed the little comedy promo beforehand.
Oh, it's great.
It's classic, classic sort of Piper.
Bye-bye.
Really fun stuff. And the Savage and Flair match, which we've already alluded to, which was another great match. Both of which had a bit of colour.
Yeah.
Brett, of course, bled hard way.
Wink.
So he claims. and Flair bled a gusher as well, which got him in trouble with Vince.
Yeah.
But the show as a whole, to me... is not good. It's not a good top to bottom show. You've got a horrific main event match.
Yeah, that main event. The two minute test of strength. The nine minute match is pretty bad.
A 2 minute test of strength. The botched run in from Papa Shango, where Sid has to kick out of the leg drop.
Yeah, that was great though.
Yeah. You've got the Skinner Owen Hart throwaway. It ends with a victory roll and Owen Hart's face looks a mess because he's got the Skinner tobacco spat in his face.
Oh, the dip. Yeah, that's gross.
You've got the terrible tag title match with Money Inc. and the Natural Disasters.
That is awful.
Yeah, this is all second half
Roberts,
of the show.
Roberts' Taker is
not
a vehicle
good.
For Taker, but it's not a good match.
Yeah.
Tatanka Rick Martel with the Lumpy Indians, as Bobby Heenan called them. It was another great bit of fun. And the way that Monsoon and Heenan backtrack to the previous title match and sort of they're still going back and forth.
Yeah.
It is a nice touch, but Tatanka Martel's not a great match.
I will say, I'm not sure if it was on this card or if it was at SummerSlam. I know it was in 92 when Rick Martel made the comment that Tatanka wouldn't be able to make the match because he's outside scalping tickets.
that's Mania 8. Yeah. That's Mania 8. And then one that I really think I need to get to. Right. The eight man tag match. People think my comedy routine and my shtick during these podcasts is stale, go back and watch Ray Coombs.
Combs.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Who the fuck's Ray Coombs?
I thought it was pronounced that way because it was 00.
Was it? Or was that just the typo that you saw online somewhere?
His shtick, what was it? If the Nasty Boys each had half a brain, they would still only have half a brain.
That's great stuff.
You're laughing because it's terrible, not because it's genuine.
What do you know
funny.
About comedy, Carl?
The only person who's laughing during any of this, I think, is Monsoon. And that's probably
in the Michael Cole position.
Michael Cole position. For God's sake, make this look half decent. It's a terrible shtick. It's a terrible match. it shows just how far Slaughter's fallen in a year. And then you've got the promo, the heel promo in the locker room beforehand.
How annoying is that?
What
promo?
An absolute clusterfuck that is. So to summarise, folks, Mania 8, two great matches and a lot of shit for the rest of it. Personally, I've always had the impression that Mania 8 benefits from the fact that, obviously, Mania 7 and in my opinion, Mania 9, either side of it, aren't particularly good shows.
I think 7 is.
But 7 doesn't get a good rep, does it?
I think it's worse rep than it deserves.
Because of the storyline,
yeah,
involving yeah. Slaughter and Hogan, and the whole farcical nature of trying to get the LA Coliseum and then ending up in the LA Sports Arena, and I'm probably doing the card itself a bit of a disservice. In truth, I admit that. But Mania 7 has a stigma. Mania 9 has a stigma because Mania 9 is a fucking terrible show. The world's largest toga party, apparently.
Yeah. I just want to go back to, I think the actual emailer's point was about Hogan. Okay. Hogan and Flair.
I've been sitting here for like half an hour.
We mentioned it briefly.
I was like, sitting here for half an hour. Yeah. I mean, that is probably the biggest letdown of the year, I think, from an artistic point of view. They get fucking Ric Flair and nothing happens with him and Hogan of value.
On TV.
Yeah. My question would be, they went to it straight away on house shows.
Which is the...
Were they... Yeah, I mean, the fact that they went to it straight away, what was even the long... Were they even planning to go to it at Mania? Because to me, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, well, this is the thing, and obviously this is broaching into 91, so we won't go too deeply into this, but it does have 92 implications. I think they missed the ball in the sense that it's a big show match, and WCW proved it when they put it on pay-per-view. It did extremely well.
It did draw, did it?
Oh, it did massively.
Yeah, that's making my point.
Turned around WCW on pay-per-view, and it was just one of those things where, for whatever reason, and part of it was the timing, getting him in September was a little bit of an awkward timing for Flair, and the anticipation for the match was never going to be higher than when they first got him in, and at risk of him becoming just another guy, as WWE is wont to do, and not push guys as outsiders very well. I don't know why they didn't do it.
I just think it was set up to fail is probably a bit harsh and a bit extreme, but maybe it's the not wanting to having the two Flair and Hogan face to face and do you because I think at the back of his mind, how long was Flair going to be around himself?
Yeah,
he got him. Yeah, we got him now, but I think he, looking back logically, it was only going to be a matter of time before he got pissed off, didn't like how he was positioned, and where he was going to go back. So I don't know. Maybe it was a halfway house, and Vince himself was kind of hedging his bets, and I just the timing of it for me didn't make sense. That if you get Flair in, surely you're going to put whether it's Mania, whether it's a Rumble, you're going to put a point in time. So that's what we're building to, and that's where we're going to make our money. Yeah. And you get Flair in, then and it's completely haphazard almost, and even the Rumble thing for me. I mean, you still got Hogan as the top guy, and when it finishes, the talking Hogan as well is like, it's not all Ric Flair, is it? It was still Hogan's Sid story.
Yeah,
so.
Well, that's the interesting point, like you say. As much as I've sort of waxed lyrical earlier in the podcast and previously about Rumble 92, it is telling the fact that Flair wins. He's hurried to the back. You have Hogan and Sid square off. Then I think it goes to the Flair promo, which, as we've said before, is a great promo. Then it goes back to the ring. And it probably didn't help matters that you've then got Sid, you know, acting real heelish and separating the referees and getting down on one knee, challenging Hogan. Hogan doesn't know what the hell to do.
And the crowd is just fucking on fire for Sid, which is hilarious.
So it's a real weird ending to the show.
Hogan healed on him, he pulled him out of the ring.
We're going to elaborate on it right now.
Hulk Hogan was the heel in that situation. He had eliminated his friends from behind in the previous years on the Rumble. It was every man for himself. Fuck you, Hogan.
Where it's like, okay, Hogan's a sore loser. Sid eliminated him. Sid eliminated him, and it's like, you know, he just holds his hand and helps Flair beat him. He's just like, you sulky little twat.
I can't win, you can't win either.
He didn't even beat up Sid. He grabbed his hand and
then ran off.
Pussy.
Bad news getting up for the ugly. Eric Watts, that says it all. Say what you will about Greg Gagne and say what you will about Greg Gagne and Dustin Rhodes, but Greg had a great tag team with Jim Brunzell in the AWA, and Dustin Rhodes' career speaks for itself. And you could at least tell there was something there when he debuted. Eric Watts looked like shit, couldn't wrestle, and had zero personality. His STF that he applied at the Clash to submit Bobby Eaton made John Cena's STF look like William Regal.
I agree.
Yeah, we're really going to talk about Eric Ross.
This would finally culminate in 93 at Super Bowl when the live crowd boos him out the building for being a Watts, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
Slicky Tricky Damon from TPWW. Good. HBK gets his first singles title after beating the Bulldog on Saturday night's main event.
Yep.
Fan of Sean winning the belt when he did?
No, because it was still coming off the 92 SummerSlam. Feel good factor, and before I knew it, he'd lost it, and I was pissed off by that. And Sean, to me, it was kind of a non-factor at that point until his IC run.
Yeah, like we said, Michaels was treading water through no fault of his own. Really, his original plan had gone up in smoke, no pun intended.
Yeah.
And I was just completely astounded by it.
Alright, so we've run the gamut of 1992, we've talked about so many different elements, we're going to summarise it now. For us around the table, what do you think summarises good, bad and ugly in this year for you?
I'll go ugly, start of the last. Ugly, obviously the public perception of the scandals. Bad, the elevation of... Sorry, the use of the world titles, in particular on both brands.
Yeah.
And the emphasis to put on people like Brett in particular. When he was needed, but as a good, at least the opportunity was there for those guys, which further down the line actually paid off. But yeah,
good. Much like Kieran said, it's the elevation of new talent. However, it may have been mishandled. You know, the rewards were there in the end. So the starting point of that is a good for me. The bad is just the general level of creative in the second half of 92. You know, Bill Watts in WCW, Vince, because of the way his hand is forced, is sort of rushed into everything, so nothing comes across particularly well. And the ugly, you can't avoid the scandals.
Yeah.
The scandals, you know, for any good and bad that may have been throughout the year, the scandals are the overriding theme of the year.
For me, as a kid, good. Just for two primary reasons. Macho Man Randy Savage got back his world title, and also just for the general experience of SummerSlam 92, just being here in UK at that time, even though I didn't get to see it in person like Carl or see it live at the time, I had to watch it the next day on tape. Just the hype going into that show and just the general feeling of it was just very electric, even if the quality of the overall show wasn't great. As an adult, it's probably a little bit more mixed. Looking back in retrospect, obviously the huge, you know, like stain on the curtain, which is the steroid situation, obviously all the sex scandals and so on is also really bad. But looking back to it, the main key thing in retrospect I always enjoyed is the quality of heels that we had throughout that year. I mean, you know, where we've already talked about Dangerous Alliance. I guess I'm not going to have too much time to talk about the Heenan Perfect Flair combination, the Team Flair, which was just absolutely fantastic, I thought, from beginning to end. Just the entertainment value those three brought to each other and the chemistry, just like it felt like those three had been working together all their lives. It was just that good. You know, Big Van Vader, Shawn Michaels' is run, you know, was pretty decent as well. Cactus Jack, I think, was a heel at that time. And also Razor Ramon debuted this year as well, who was another guy who I was really into. So for me, it was like all the heels that would come through, all these fresh heel acts after like a couple of years of, you know, quite a lot of boredom from the heel side of things.
The good is Murray Hodgson's speech. The bad is Dave Meltzer's hair. The ugly is Vince McMahon's suit. And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to apologise if you weren't able to get to your feedback on this show. We just had so much to get to. Thank you very much for all the feedback. Thank you very much for listening. For Kieran O'Rourke.
You're welcome.
For Carl Jones.
As always, thanks for having me.
And for G. John Chase.
I hate to say we told you so, but we told you so.
Thank you very much for listening. We are out of here.
Told us what? I don't get it.
And you wanna have a fist fight? I can run faster, I can jump higher, I can...